horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
A very good Wednesday, race fans. Sirius 219, XM 201. Sports Zone 964, if you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website as well, stevebeck.com. And I'm going to start the morning really with the same way we started yesterday, including a continuing Mardi Gras wish. But the, you know, the paralyzed portion of the country with the incredible cold and its damage continues to be, a tough story to ignore, and not to express concern for everybody being affected. And in fact, we're going to have the first portion of the morning, first visit anyway, to touch on it, and somebody that answers every bell when it comes to misfortune and natural disasters. This, to be honest, this feels in partly, in certain parts of Texas, like a kind of a Johnstown flood moment. For those that know the backstory of the Johnstown flood. But Jim McInvale, Mattress Mac, is going to join us in about 3 or 4 minutes. And I wanted to get Mac on to discuss the remarkable automatic largesse that's involved with his approach to, I'm not going to say approach to business, because it's obviously way beyond the business, but Mac opening, the gallery furniture facilities to people that require shelter. And he does this every time there's anything that is displacing not just people in Houston, but, wherever he seems able to help, he does. And and because he's irrepressible, we undoubtedly will touch on his Super Bowl bet and everything else going on. Ron Happy, who is starting to get some traction, as in fact we kind of hinted at as recently as last week. He didn't ever seem like a natural to have precocious horses. He's a son of Super Saver. He's not, he's also not a natural, even the sprint portion. Anyway, I'll bring it up with Sid later too, because Sid's going to join us. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. But in just a couple of minutes, Mattress Mac. And look forward, even under the difficult conditions, and you'll get an understanding. If you haven't, I'm sure most of us in one setting or another have heard Mac talk about his approach to life. So we'll get a visit in with Mac shortly. Later, in addition to Sid, I also want to highlight that after Mac joins us, Dave Hill, and Dave Hill is speaking of being on a roll. Dave, in 2 weeks ago, the news that the Vapors was optioned and is going to go toward production of a series, and his two pieces the last 2 weeks, one directly related to racing, his piece for ABR about Twitch and its potential to bring racing and handicapping and the aura of the game to a wider and potentially younger audience. And then the piece, what's today, Wednesday, so I think it must have hit on Monday, his piece for The Ringer on GameStop. If you have not seen it, I'll retweet it shortly before he joins us. It's an unbelievably warm and uplifting, frankly, piece about a dabbler, more than a dabbler. That's not fair. A dedicated. I'm underselling really the Michael McCaskill success story involving GameStop and McCaskill from Louisville. And a self-described beach bum, and he was way out in front on GameStop as a potential investment. Going back to 2019, and so he wasn't part of the hoo-ha involving the Reddit group. He was out on this and frankly out on a limb repeatedly for essentially a year and a half or more. But really, there's so many parallels to the story that Dave wrote that to the racing, to the industry, to horseplay, to approaches, etc. I think if you haven't read it yet, bookmark it and read it, listen to Dave, and you'll really enjoy it. So Dave Hill this morning, probably about 9:20, right till 10 o'clock. But right now, it's a pleasure to have Jim McInvale join us. And with this weather emergency and with the power disaster that's befallen Texans, Mac steps up again and always at the ready to help, whether it's floodings and hurricanes or anything. Jim, good morning. And as always, the racing industry particularly is always impressed and touched by your largesse.
How are you, Steve? Great to be on At the Races. Once again, we've had another weather emergency in Houston, and we were lucky enough to be able to step up and help some of these folks. There's hundreds of them in the stores. I'm looking around right now, eating and waking up, getting ready to start the day. A lot of them already left here to go to work, so it's a sad situation, but hopefully a happy situation as we try very hard in the next 3 or 4 days to get the power back on and get things back to normal here in Texas.
Mac, how many people are you sheltering?
You know, we had in and out of here yesterday over probably 1,000 people, Steve. We had about 300 sleep here overnight. Got probably that many here eating breakfast today. And we'll reopen for new people to get out of the storm at 10 o'clock. And we should have a lot of people in here for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then probably 300 of them sleep here overnight. So the same story, second verse, same as we did during Hurricane Harvey. And it's all about taking responsibility for the well-being of the community.
Well, and you've done this, and frankly, even if you were a less high-profile commercial business entity, you'd be doing this, quietly and anonymously. I won't suggest that you think of this as an obligation, because you just run into the breach whenever there's anything that you can do.
Yeah, it is an obligation. You know, there's a saying, to whom much has been given, much is expected. My father and mother taught me that the essence of living is giving, so I'm trying to teach these same values to my children, which I think I have, and my wife has, and to our grandchildren, of which we have many. So, to much has been given, much is expected, and when times get tough, it's time for us to step up and help these people here.
Now, and how many, I never really notice when these stories, come out and it reaches national news, of course. But, how many units, how many stores are involved?
Well, we have two stores involved. The one store out in Richmond, sprinklers leaked all over the store, major snafu and water everywhere. People slept there last night, but right now we're closed over there because we don't have any power. At the main store, the North Freeway store, where all the people are, where I'm at, we have a giant generator with 15,000 gallons of diesel fuel fueling us for the next 4 or 5 days. So we'll have people in and out continuously the next several days as we try to make their lives a little bit brighter during this tough time where they have no power, no electricity, no water, no lights at their home.
Looking at the forecast, and we do see that back up into the 30s, and it'll continue as the week goes into the weekend, into the 40s and 50s, and a week from today it'll be 73 in Houston, and the problem's going to be that the damage involved. I saw scenes mostly from the Dallas area of the pipes bursting, as you just allude. I mean, even when a thaw occurs, that's when a lot of this damage, and so it's just an epic disaster that that is going to continue and impact people's lives for for a while.
Yeah, hundreds if not thousands of people, pipes burst and got water over their house, ruined their house, the carpet, the furniture, the flooring. So it's just as you said, a disaster of tremendous proportions that really wasn't expected. We're used to 70-degree weather in February. Now it's in the teens or in 10, 9, or 8. So it's tough for us, but tough times nevertheless. Steve, tough Texans do. We'll get through this together.
Well, the admiration for the way in which you run into the breach on these occasions is just you can't be appreciated or complimented enough for it's automatic, Mac, with you. And so when the headline started up a couple of days ago, it says, of course. You say to yourself, of course Mac is stepping up. In terms of feeding people and in terms of having an operation at the ready, talk about how that's come together in terms of a mobile kitchen and you must be pretty, your people must be pretty polished by now.
Yeah, I've had a meteorologist as a friend of mine who trades oil and gas futures, so he kind of predicted this whole thing to me. So we went out and got the diesel for the generators. We got everything lined up, and we've been able to help a lot of people, and we were at the ready when it was time to go, and we're still at the ready. So whatever people need, we're there to help them.
Well, Mac, while we've got you too, in terms of more frivolous mattress Mac activity, we watched as you dove into Super Bowl. How'd your Super Bowl action turn out?
Yeah, we had a mattress promotion for Super Bowl Tampa Bay versus whoever the heck they played. I guess they played
Kansas City.
we picked Kansas City. The customers got Kansas City, so I made a big hedge bet on Tampa Bay. And thanks to Tom Brady and Gronkowski and all the rest of those guys, they pulled it out. So I won $3.6 million on that bet. That was a good return and made a lot of people in Houston happy because they got a whole lot of them got free mattresses.
Well, and hopefully anybody that has had a damaged mattress, they still can come in and get new ones. I also have got to talk to you a little bit about the way in which Run Happy is starting to get some traction, and the first stake winner over the weekend, and as these Run Happy 3-year-olds mature, Mac, they're starting to find the end zone, and it seems to me that there was just too much of a presumption that he was going to get precocious horses. That seemed a little a little overambitious by people, and I think it made them rush to condemn him after just a couple of months of racing of the progeny.
Yeah, that was partly my part by putting up that $100,000 2-year-old bonus. But you live and you learn. And I got my sister-in-law Laura, who trains the horses for us. She got a text the other day from a lady who they helped raise Maria's mom. They talked about how he didn't have any winners until he was a 3-year-old, and then Derby winner and became a very successful sire. So The comeback of Run Happy is fast underway. Two big winners he had last week, one Saturday at Fairgrounds, the other Sunday, which was spectacular. Nikki the Vest at Aqueduct. So Run Happy's looking good. They're running. The farther they go, looks like the better they get, and I think that's a good thing. So we're very pleased with Run Happy. Couldn't be happy with his 2021 success. 2020 was not a good year for a lot of people. Won the best year ever for Run Happy, but 2021 looks brighter and better, and there is a wonderful light at the end of this tunnel.
Well, and that includes for the people that are suffering right now due to the just devastation associated with this winter storm that has paralyzed great swaths of the country, not just the Southeast and environs. Mac, again, just tremendous appreciation. Let me speak for the industry and. How impressed and how grateful everybody is for the way you represent the sport when it comes to your approach to, these kinds of emergencies.
Well, one thing, Steve, Nick Zito taught me many years ago that horse racing is a game you got to play with iron breeches on because there's lots of ups and lots of downs, a whole lot more downs than ups. And horse racing, if anything, has taught me resilience, and I'm a resilient human being. The team that works me out here at Galley Furniture is resilient. The people of Houston, Texas are resilient, and we will get through this storm, and we'll find that bright light at the end of the tunnel because we're all in this together.
Now, inspiring words and an inspiring attitude and approach to life by Jim McInvale, Mattress Mac. Mac, thanks so much. We'll hope to see you along the way this year. You've got some horses that are out, and it seems like there might be a couple that are going to make their way into some stakes this season.
Couple that can make some noise for the great Run Happy. We look forward to that. Look forward to the next call, not being about some weather tragedy, but being about Run Happy's triumph. So look forward to that, Steve.
Jim McInvale. Mac, thanks so much.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Jim McInvale, Mattress Mac, and you can follow Mac on Twitter. And he brings a real faith-based approach to his life, and it's hard not to kind of smile. You listen to him, and he's always got an upbeat way about him, when you talk about his time in the game. I mean, today wasn't the day to have that discussion, but he mentions Nick Zito, and he had the success with Baffert going back now. It's probably 20 years with Wimbledon, and then he had a kind of a long drought, with just some okay horses, and he had some fits and starts, Run Happy, just a huge success for him, and felt like years of distilled success or approach for success. So hard not to appreciate and root for Mac. And it's funny, he's got some horses that have been knocking on the door himself, that he's had a bunch of, he's only had four starters this year, but he's got 3 seconds in maidens. Fast Happy and Factual, and he's got a couple of others that see if he's got anybody starting. I should have looked to see if he's got a starter. No starters. I take that back. That would have had a horse run at Oaklawn on Thursday, but of course everything rebooted for next weekend and next week, 25th through the 28th. In fact, speaking of Oaklawn, Dave Hill is going to join us, and Casey, you could reach for Dave, and we'll go right into our conversation with him. I mentioned yesterday, Hammer sent me a snapshot of a weather forecast that had a Arkansas map with just the craziest, you know, it's not like it doesn't get cold in the winter in Arkansas, but not, you know, not what they're dealing with right now. I think for them, I think the power remains on anyway. Right now, let's see, 16 degrees in Hot Springs, and I think they're getting more snow again today, 4 to 8 inches of additional snow today, at least in Houston. The temperatures are moderating, but as I mentioned, if you haven't seen the videos of the pipes breaking and water gushing out of buildings, it's just unbelievable. Dave Hill joins us, and Dave, I was waiting for you. I mentioned that weather map I sent you the other night that Rick Hammerly sent me. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, it's wild. I think I saw somewhere that something like 75% of America is covered in snow right now.
Unbelievable. When I saw -7 in Fayetteville, I
and they're losing their minds down there. And I guess rightfully so. You know, and this is a state where there's no snow plows and nobody has any shovels or boots. I mean, it's just like, you know, they're not prepared.
No, and they're going to have to kind of wait it out. Rick Hammerly was with us yesterday with the update on what's happening at Oaklawn, you know, postponing everything until next Thursday through Sunday and reshuffling the deck for the stake schedule. And he had a friend, somebody in the racing office that's got a 4x4 and, you know, had to pick him up because the roads are just ice covered and there's not going to be relief. I mean, they're going to have to wait until it melts. So, we got everybody. We just had Mattress Mac on talking about what he's dealing with and how he's helping mm-hmm. Houstonians. It's unbelievable. And here at least it's not unusual. We had an inch of ice yesterday while I was on the air, Tina went out and clear everything.
Yeah. My mom is always like, I couldn't live like this all the time. And I tell her, well, we don't live like that. We in New York, we wake up in the morning and the street has been plowed for us. You know, it's we're prepared.
Exactly. And it's only, you know, it's 90 days, give or take 100 days, you know, mm-hmm. Seasonality. But anyway, I was thinking of you with all the Arkansas news. Meanwhile, let's take this piece by piece. The first order of business, when you were on last month, you absolutely were cold watering and playing possum with what was going on behind the scenes, because within, I think, 10 days came word in the entertainment trades that the Vapors had been optioned. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. It's big news. It's kind of old news to me because the deal was made a while back, but it only got announced then. So I wasn't really trying to play possum. I had no idea they were going to put that press release out, or else I'd maybe said something about it. But yeah, it's pretty cool. I'm hopeful that that something will come of it. But I'm trying to be cautiously up. The entertainment business is a wild business, right? Like they throw a lot of money at stuff that they never do anything with. So I don't want to get too hopeful and get let down.
Well, the thing, and I read from the Deadline piece, the people that are involved are you know, major players that have had very recent big time successes on HBO, and I was sort of taken by one line in there that I wanted to ask you about, and I forgot to inquire. It talked about, I guess it was Alex Metcalf that this was something that he was excited about. Was that some sort of a conflation of your background?
Right. No, it's not actually. Alex is his father is, and his father's family are all from Arkansas.
Wow.
And so his dad, you know, was really involved in gambling in Arkansas back in the day. And when Alex was growing up, he would visit Arkansas quite often. And so he had a lot of, you know, memories and connections to the area, but he especially always was kind of, he loved his father's stories about the gambling world back in the day. So he was familiar with the story when the book came out, and he had told me that he'd always had it in the back of his mind that he thought one day it'd be great to write something about Hot Springs, but he just didn't know enough about it. You know, he could never find any good source material to work from, and so when the book came out, he just felt like it was delivered unto him by God, you know. It was a miracle that this happened, because it's something he had always wanted to do.
I saw that line, that it was, of personal, and I thought, wait a minute, it's personal to Dave Hill. So to find a second individual to attach to the project that is so inspired by the story, it just feels like the momentum is there, Dave, and of course we'll all be waiting to find, to see how all the Hill family and kin are, going to find their way into it.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Keep our fingers crossed.
Well, you've got to, there's got to be a role for you. Well, another story that there were two things that Dave, as I mentioned at the top of the show before Mattress Mac joined us, the story, now it's almost 2 weeks, for ABR about Twitch, and we'll get to that second, because the story this week in The Ringer of Michael McCaskill and his success with the GameStop phenomena is just spectacular. And I can only imagine, as it was happening, as the GameStop thing was happening, Dave, you were tracking it, and you were, you were commenting, even to the point of saying, who's going to write the definitive story? And then you end up writing, we all thought Mark Hopkins would get it, but this story is even better than the Reddit team. This is a guy that was digging and researching and was in position to benefit and was going to benefit long term one way or the other. It's an amazing story.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I mean, when The Ringer kind of asked me if I was interested in writing by GameStop, and I wasn't sure that I was, because like everybody in America, I was fascinated by what was happening, but I didn't feel like I was particularly, qualified to to dig into it or write on it. But not just because of my, not being heavily involved in that world, but also just not having kind of the contacts that I thought I would need to be able to write about, Reddit and these Wall Street Bets characters, et cetera. But then I started thinking about that movie, The Big Short, and how, in the movie and in the book, they kind of tell the story of the housing crisis from all these different people who arrived at this idea, the same idea from different angles. And I thought that has to be true here too. There have to be people other people who found this completely on their own. And so I went looking for any kind of message board or social media posts I could find from all the way back into early, 2019, to see who was talking about this company and this stock and this idea. And that's where I found Mike, who was haunting these Investor Hub and these message boards, and he was kind of trying to get people to talk to him about this thing he was seeing in GameStop way earlier than Roaring Kitty or any of these other Reddit guys that we've heard about. So I thought that was interesting, and I reached out. At the time, I didn't know how much money he had made. I just knew that he was early on the trade, so I reached out to him. And once I reached out to him and found out the full story, I thought, wow, how lucky am I? I can't believe I found this guy. Because it turns out that he really went from rags to riches on this stock and made an insane amount of money.
And one of the reasons that, I love talking to you anyway and showcasing your work, but there are so many parallels, Dave, and I don't know if you felt this as you were gathering the backstory and the information, and then when you wrote it, but anybody that is involved in the business or is a horse player is going to see obvious parallels to horseplay and gambling on horses in any way, shape, or form, buying them, breeding them. It absolutely lives and breathes. And the fact that Michael McCaskill's from Louisville, sort of makes it even that much more
yeah.
racing related.
Yeah, his family. He grew up in Louisville. His family's all from Louisville, and they also were involved in racing. At one point, they owned horses. When he was a kid, he said he was in a lot of winter circle photos because his family would be in partnerships and stuff, and owned a bunch of horses. Although I didn't get that through that story because I think Mike has kind of sworn off horse racing for for a different type of gambling. But he used a lot of we definitely talked a lot about horse racing as metaphors to explain this or that. When we were talking, it was a language that I could understand that we both spoke. But I think the biggest parallel here is that, Mike's strategy was to play these out of the money options that were really, really cheap to buy, but were really unlikely to hit unless they were basically like playing long shots. His whole philosophy was, I'm going to lose a small investment on these most of the time, but if I hit one, it's going to be huge. And so, he played that out. He played that strategy for 20 years, and it didn't work for him, and then it finally worked. So, you could walk away from the story and think, well, he got lucky, and that's not going to happen for most people, and that's true, and I think he even acknowledges that. But this is a guy who did finally get lucky and hit one that paid off big for him. And I think the other thing that was important to kind of take away from his story is that when he finally did notice that what was happening with GameStop was what he thought would happen with GameStop was happening, he really backed it up. He dumped a lot of money into it as it was happening. Once he kind of had that confirmation, and so it wasn't like this isn't a guy that bet $10,000 and made $20 million. He started out betting $10,000, but once he kind of realized it might happen, he was pushing everything that he could get his hands on. And his whole net worth, right? So he really made an all-in bet at one point, where he would go broke if this didn't happen, and instead he got filthy rich, which I thought was interesting.
We'll save the specific amount that he and members of the family were able to hit for in the GameStop scenario, but parts
no
of this,
spoilers, right?
Exactly. We'll keep people. We'll keep them hanging on. Some of the notes I took as I read: low investment, high reward. Which is certainly a viable. It's not the only way to play the races, but it's certainly very viable. Parts of the equation. Involving the options, Dave, one of the conversations going on in the industry right now is the opportunity to plug in fixed odds and the parallels, to options from that standpoint. I thought that his trying to get on a prior experience when he was up $950,000 at one point and didn't get out in time because he was trying to get to $1 million, mentally. There was the idea that he was playing 30-1 shots, knowing that you only have to hit so many in the scheme of things. You can strike out repeatedly if you hit, that 30-1. There's so much. I thought that part about him understanding GameStop's technical positives when everybody else, when the hedge funds were shorting, and he understood the attributes of the horse in this case.
He even used that. That was a particular moment when we were talking that he used a horse racing analogy too, because he said, look, you can go to the track. A lot of people will go to the track and they have all kinds of ways that they'll, bet on a horse. Maybe they watch the post parade and they like the way it looks, or they like the jockey and the trainer, the sort of real superficial level of, how they make their decisions. And he said a lot of people pick stocks that way too. They'll say, oh, this stock had a good quarter, or, you know, this has got a good price to earnings ratio. But he said, you know, they've got the racing form there. There's so much more data you can dig into. Why don't you, you know, it's there for you to use. He said, that's kind of how I felt about, you know, looking into companies. Like, the more data I can look at, the more research I can do, the better of a choice I can make.
Exactly. I want to establish as many of the the industry ties as possible. And I thought one of the other things that he seemed to learn, because as you referenced, I mean, this is over, you know, 20 years of playing penny stocks, the OTC market, and learning as he went. And one of the things I thought that was a parallel was, you know, the penny stock attempts. And I akin it to mentally to buying horses for, you know, $7,500 and $10,000, $15,000, and you know, trying to get lucky that way versus, you know, spending more on buying, you know, a potentially, you know, better quality horse. And it seems like he, you know, came to that conclusion at a certain point, and that's what got him looking at the big board.
Yeah, you know, I remember talking once to Alan Dinkinson, you know, Dinky, who
sure
is a pretty well-known sports gambler. And I remember him saying that to me, that the reason he prefers to betting on horses to betting on sports, even though he's really made his living betting on sports for life, was that, you know, in sports you really got to, you have to grind. You know, you have to try to be right 54% of the time to grind out a 1% or 2%. You know, earn, and that's, you know, that means you're investing a lot of money, and you're just to make a little bit of money. And he said, and horse racing is a great game for people who are recreational gamblers, because unlike in sports, you really can go to the track and invest, have less money and make more. You know, you can hit, you can find value, you can hit long shots in a way that you really can't in sports. I mean, I know there's parlays, you know, that people can play, but those are much harder to hit than finding a good, you know, a good 6-to-1 shot at the track that could win. That's far more likely than, you know, whatever, hitting a 5-team parlay or something. So he felt like, you know, racing is more fun. It's more, in that way, it makes it more accessible, more fun to gamblers, and it's a good place to gamble on a short bankroll. And I thought about that. Like, you know, Mike said that when he was day trading, a lot of the people that he associated with, other traders, day and swing traders that he knew, they were grinders. You know, they tried to grind out a couple hundred bucks a day, making trades all day long. And that just didn't appeal to him. You know, he didn't want to grind out a living sitting in front of his computer screen. He wanted to, like, he thought it was more fun to look for the long shots. He wanted to really swing for the fences and see if he could turn what all he could do, how high he could run $1,000 up, you know, rather than trying to take that thousand and earn like $100 a day or something. And so he just took a different approach. He had a different risk strategy. He had a wife who had a good job, and he, you know, he lived within his means and didn't have a lot of expenses. So it was easier for him to do that. He knew what his risk tolerance was, but to him, he wanted to see what, you know, how high he could get it. And, so he played the game a little differently, but you could also trade stocks. A lot of his friends and some of the people I interviewed for the story traded completely different from him. You know, they were right alongside of him on the same stocks, but they were trading it in a less risk, less volatile way so that they could earn a smaller amount of money, but have a higher, you know, less, they were risking less.
One of the other elements of this too, that is to me really inspiring, is his self-confidence. He may have questioned decisions along the way, but he never questioned his skill and his, you know, overall belief in himself. And it's obvious, Dave, from your right, you know, your telling of the story, that the relatives that you know, his family, were absolutely convinced of his correctness and that, you know, that his advice and his direction was worth following. There weren't any you know, there might have been some naysaying, but they all came along.
Yeah, I think that Mike would say that his relatives probably, they all knew that he had had plenty of stocks that he lost money on, but that when Mike was really enthusiastic enough to really tout it to everybody, that meant something, right? That he didn't always do that. And so the few times that he was really touting stuff to people, it usually hit. And I give a couple examples in the story. There were a couple others that I left out just because it was getting long. But, you know, he had a few big winners along the way that really paid off for people. And his family would always make more money than he did because he'd hold on for too long. He'd keep going while they all cashed out. and I think that was kind of the thing everybody thought was so funny about GameStop, was that the reputation he had among his friends and family was that he'd pick winners, but he'd get greedy, and he would refuse to take his profits off, and he'd say it could go a little bit higher, it can go a little bit higher, and then he'd lose because he'd miss his moment. And GameStop was the moment where that finally worked, right? Where everybody else cashed out, and he said it could go a little bit higher, and this time he was right; it went a lot higher, and it made him a lot of money.
Talk a little bit about the research that went into this for you, and you one of the other ties to racing. It's funny, this all starts to some degree with message board culture, and as you referenced, you know, you kind of came across him that way. But racing too. I mean, we from the early internet days, the way he waded into this, into the markets, it is really I'm 61, and my interest in the game accelerated and was heightened by message board culture. Came across the ESPN horse racing board, and eventually I started my own with Derby Trail, and it's an interesting tie. But talk about what went into this for you. I mean, you're familiar with every single form of gambling that exists, including the market. And, talk about, getting the technical aspect of this right and reaching, some people for the piece that were integral to the whole telling.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is true that that Mike kind of got into this world through, the internet and discovering. I think he first got introduced into the market through his stepfather and through another guy who he worked with who was older. Neither of those folks were sort of tied into the internet. The internet was very young and new at that point. But Mike, being a younger guy, did take to the internet, and he discovered a lot of other people his age who were, sort of starting message boards and using, sharing information and trying to, do all kinds of shenanigans on the penny stock exchanges. But yeah, I think that that carried him forward and carried a whole generation of traders forward who were really online and formed these communities where they could help each other out. So that was definitely a big part of it. I interviewed a number of, experts. I interviewed a quantitative analyst who had a PhD in physics, who spent many, many years as a quant in a number of banks, and I interviewed him to explain some things to me. I interviewed another guy who runs a fund in Boston, and I talked to friends of mine who knew a lot more about this stuff. I also had another woman, Katie Baker, who is a writer at The Ringer, who used to work at Goldman Sachs, who left a career at Goldman Sachs to be a journalist, and she read it. We had a number of people, a lot of eyes were on the story before it published, just to make sure, because I don't think anybody at The Ringer even felt like they would know, they would be able to fact check some of the stuff in the story, because, some of the stuff gets really into the weeds. So we had to have a lot of eyes on the story, and there still were probably errors, it's just a difficult thing to write about for a lay audience. I think what people who nitpick some of the errors that may come up in the story don't realize is that it's not, a lot of times mistakes come when you are trying to dumb something down, so to speak, right? Like if I'm trying to take something that I feel like I understand, but I need to write it in a way that makes it more accessible, or explain it in a way that makes it more accessible to the lay audience, then errors will enter in, right? And that's why sometimes that financial speak is so indecipherable, is because it's so precise, and making it more understandable means making it less precise, which makes it more error prone. So I hate that. It makes me cringe because I don't want to come across like a complete buffoon. I am a complete buffoon, but I'd like to at least come across in the writing, like, you know, like I'm not just making stuff up. But this is a big challenge about writing about stuff for later on. It even happens with writing about gambling. You know, gambling has its own language and its own kind of code words and its own kind of, you know, lexicon. And I think that I've got to, often if I'm writing about horse racing, say, for a general interest or a general sports audience, sometimes I have to explain things in a way that I normally wouldn't, because there's just certain terms I have to avoid using, or have to explain things in a way that makes it less precise.
The precision of the dominoes in this story is remarkable. And here's McCaskill on his own trolley track, essentially, while there's super highways and high speed rail yeah. around, and he's, you know, he's digging and doing what he's done, you know, basically distilling years of experience into understanding that there were things about GameStop that were appealing, and then discovering, you know, this leveraged scenario where there were people just convinced on the hedge market that they were destined for failure and bankruptcy. And, you know, so those wheels are turning. But in the meantime, what's amazing about your story, Dave, is the next several layers, including Michael Burry's involvement, famed for The Big Short, Keith Gill's involvement, and Ryan Cohen. I mean, there were a series of things that happened here that it's like a Rube Goldberg machine.
Yeah. This is why I really feel like there was, in the end, my suspicion that there was a parallel to The Big Short was right. I mean, there wasn't just one group of people or one player here. You know, there were a lot of players, and it was sort of a perfect storm in a way. And I think that, you know, Mike's involvement in this that I thought was so key was that he tipped off Jim Cramer, who then talked about it on his show, and that's really what sparked, you know, the rally. And I thought that was an important role that he played, but that on its own would not have done it, right? And I think that that, you know, it's the media, the sort of story about GameStop prior to this was that this group of people on investors on Reddit were kind of pulling some shenanigans, right? That they were sort of on their own triggering this big short squeeze by buying and buying and buying and holding and trying to trigger it. And I think that story that has been told has completely wrong, right? I think that was happening, but that was not cause, that was effect, right? Like they saw this and were investing, but that the squeeze was going to happen because of the actual value of the company. And I think what Mike's story shows is that well before there was any Reddit group, there were investors like Mike who picked up, and like Michael Burry, who picked up on the fact that GameStop is overshorted, that GameStop actually was a good company and had a good shot at making a lot of money, and that the price was too low. And so it was just an undervalued stock, which is what any traditional stock investor should do, is look for a company that's undervalued and buy it. And that's what that's all they were doing. The fact that the short squeeze happened was just sort of like the icing on the cake. But the truth is, Mike McCaskill would have bought GameStop without the short interest list because he thought at $4 it was an absurdly low price for a company that could very well rebound with new management. So he believed in the company. He still does. He's still out there touting it. He's saying buy GameStop, you know, that there's a future for GameStop, that Ryan Cohen is going to turn GameStop into the Amazon for video games. And he did it with Chewy. And, you know, and if you look at Chewy's financials and you look at GameStop's, you can see that, like, there's enough money there to make this into a really well-oiled e-commerce company. That's Mike's sort of philosophy on it. So he's still out there buying it and investing in it. And so I only say that to say, I mean, I'm not buying these stocks, but I'm saying that it's a different version of the story. It's a story of people who believed in a company, invested in it, not a story about a bunch of people who were kind of pulling some market shenanigans or trying to find an angle to shoot.
Well, your specialty invariably is finding the story less told, and you did it again. I don't know if we should just, I've sent out a link to the story at The Ringer. Dave Hill with us talking about his latest and fascinating discovery of Michael McCaskill in Louisville, who is heavily involved in the youth volleyball scene, and will not the success will not change his day-to-day activities. Do we make them read the story, or do we tell them how much the McCaskill made?
They should read the story, I feel like. I already am mad at the Ringer for their headline. I feel like the reveal at the end is fun if you don't know going in.
Well, then we will make them do that, or at the very least, I'll come back tomorrow and I'll give everybody the details. What others? I got to ask this before we talk about the Twitch piece for ABR. Two things. What other stories you must have happened on to other stories that were either disastrous or equally interesting? And I'm curious if you were interested, or the New York Times did the story, but one of the most winning elements of this whole thing was 10-year-old Jaden Carr in San Antonio. His mother had the foresight to wanted to teach him about the market, and bought a handful of shares at 619, and he ended up making 3,000. I thought that was one of the sweetest stories out there.
Yeah, it was a nice story. And there were definitely, even all the people I talked to in Mike's orbit, that invested a much smaller amount of money, still came out really good. And everybody kind of made some money there. But I found some other stories that I chased for a little bit before I found Mike. And, I found four college guys who all pulled their money together and got into it, and they all made a kind of a fortune. And I thought about doing them at one point. It was, when I say a fortune to me, but nothing compared to like what Mike made. But, there's also stories out there about people who, and I think the Wall Street Journal this weekend ran a series about people who got in too late. In the story, Tom Glad refers to them as the greater fool theory, right? The greater fool that got in and bought the stock too late and then lost a lot of money too. So they're not all happy endings here. Like Mike's. In fact, I think there can't be, right? I think there can only be a couple of stories out there like Mike's that most people aren't going to have seen the kind of success he saw.
Well, you love writing about gambling in any form, all the way down to carnival games, which may be your favorite to write about. But this had it all. This had everything that makes Dave Hill's writing so engaging. There's a personal, there's personalities central to it, and somebody that risked it all and came away with let's say. More than a seven-figure score. We'll make everybody read the full piece. Meanwhile, Dave, I'm going to be late getting to this portion. I know we've only got about 6-7 minutes, but you also had the piece last week in ABR, there's been plenty of discussion about alternate media approaches to introducing the sport or popularizing the sport. And you wrote about utilizing Twitch to get to a wider audience. Talk a little bit about the origins of that and what you found out.
Well, I think Twitch is something I'm really fascinated by, and I play a lot of chess, so I've been spending a lot of time on Twitch lately because chess has really blown up on Twitch. And as somebody who's followed chess for a long time, it's been amazing for me to watch this boom of how, in the last year, people who used to just be kind of like, stars to the chess community, but really were just like kind of goofy, chess players, not professionals by any stretch, because you can't, there's only a few people that can become professional chess players, but people who were really, really some of the best players in the United States at chess suddenly were on Twitch and building huge audiences and now making six-figure incomes playing chess on Twitch. It was sort of this whole new thing that sort of blew up so quickly. And I couldn't help but think, as I got deeper into the sort of culture of Twitch, that it was such a good platform for horse racing. And I've felt that way for a while. I've suspected for a while over the past year that, like, as I watch more and more people play chess on Twitch, that this is a place that horse racing should exist. I mean, there are Twitch channels dedicated to slot machines where people film themselves playing slot machines, and they have huge audiences. And they get, you know, casinos are inviting them to come to their casino and play and live stream their play so that people can watch. Poker is another thing that's big on Twitch. And I just felt like this is something that's horse racing could really just like steal the show, because in addition to there being this sport, people can handicap live on Twitch while the viewers watch, and they can, you know, learn. They can learn to play the game that way. They can follow their bets. They can copy their bets. They can make their own bets. They can interact in the chat and argue about their bets. And it just felt like better than anything we've ever had, even being at the track, it was a place where we could really bring people together to learn the game and promote the game. And so I felt that way for a while. But then when I saw, that, you know, when Scott McKeever started his YouTube channel to promote his product, Equinage, I started, you know, I realized, like, this is it. He's doing this thing that I felt for a while is needed. He's doing it on YouTube, not on Twitch, but it's the same kind of thing. And his audience grew from, you know, under 50 people to over 500, and it took a while to get there, but it's because he diligently got on, logged on, did it twice a week, and kept going until he was able to really find an audience to find him, and then it kind of grows from word of mouth from there. I think that, like, you know, there's a real opportunity here. And now Emily Gullickson's on Twitch, and she's streaming on Twitch, and I think she's going to be a big, you know, I think it's a place where she could become a big star. But the piece I wrote really talks about how the sport needs to let the gamblers have their day in the spotlight. You know, we've spent so long in horse racing, and rightfully so, celebrating the horses, the jockeys, the trainers. Hell, we even celebrate the owners. You know what I mean? We write stories about the owners. We know all about their lives and their personalities. And I feel like the problem is that the gambler is the star of the sport that the new fans of the sport can relate to, can aspire to become. Most fans of the sport are not going to become owners or jockeys or trainers, but they could become gamblers. And so the personalities we have in this game, you know, it's like horse racing has an embarrassment of riches when it comes to big personalities across the board. And the gambling part of the sport is where we find a lot of really great personalities. And I just think that we've got to find a way to give them their, you know, their time in the sun. And I know there have been attempts to try to do this in the past, reality shows and things like that, but Twitch just seems like to be the place because it's the next generation. It's where all young people, they're spending more time watching Twitch and YouTube than they are television. I mean, that's where the eyeballs are at. And I think the sport's got to figure out how to get onto those platforms. I think that horse racing, horse players could find that there's a new stream of revenue for them there. Just the way these chess players went from earning no money playing chess to earning six figures playing chess on Twitch. You know, I think there's just it's something that's wide open, and I don't know what the future is going to look like, but I think it's going to have to involve Twitch somehow.
We talked to Scotty last year after one of his rather frequent scores. I mean, even before the Equine Edge product, was launched and came together. You know, Scotty Pick Six, and we talked about it. And in fact, Emily was on just last month as well. You know, she's got the product with John Doyle, Optics EQ. Yeah, and she was actually a subject for you on the gambling podcast as well. So you're very familiar with the personalities that you know that you approached, and particularly with what Scotty's doing. I mean, there are some obstacles in this, Dave, that some people have already encountered. You know, some of it has to do with, you know, with the somewhat onerous and some would say Byzantine rules involving simulcast and use of broadcast. That's something that's going to have to be addressed.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, and I talk about that in the piece a little bit, too, about how there have been some resistance around certain feeds being shown on Twitch. You know, who knows? Maybe there's a legal argument to be made that it's fair use. Obviously, nobody's going to want to be the first one to take on that challenge, you know? But I also think there's a way to do this without the feed, too. I mean, you lose something if you can't broadcast the feed and everybody watch the race together. But really everything that leads up to the race, you know, picking the horse, all of that can be streamed and broadcast, and then people can watch on their own computer screens, their own feeds of the race, together without it being shown on the Twitch screen. I think there's a way to do it. I really don't think that that obstacle prevents this. I think it makes it less visually appealing, and that it would be a better product if the races were on the screen, but they don't have to be, because we're not talking about a show or a broadcast here where watching the race is the, I think that the gambler, the personality is what we're watching, and the person who's picking the horses, I think people want to see that part. They want to learn about how they're picking the race, what their thought process is. They want to engage with them and talk to them. Twitch is a different medium than television, right? We're not recreating TVG. And I talk about how Scott McKeever, kind of in the early days of his show on YouTube, was kind of trying to recreate TVG. But he learned quickly that, like, when you're on a platform like YouTube or Twitch and you're live streaming, it's a different world because you can talk directly to the people who are watching the show. And you have to have a different type of show, one where you're communicating directly with the viewers. And it's just a completely different vibe. It's a completely different, type of content. And I think that's why I don't think that this obstacle about showing the race is insurmountable to us getting people on these platforms to start talking about horse racing and bringing horse racing to a new audience.
Do you sense, and I don't know how much, communication you had, throughout the industry, thinking back to the piece, I was busy reading the GameStop piece. I should have reread the Twitch piece from last week. But how readily do you think the industry is cognizant and prepared to take advantage of this and to engage in it?
I don't, one of the weird things is when we say the industry, like who that is, right? Because there's so many different people so many different kind of stakeholders here, some of whose interests align and some of them don't always align. And I think that's part of the challenge with this sport is, there's not like a league, there's not like a central league. Now, as far as the Jockey Club goes, they seem like they're very interested in figuring this out. But I think that ultimately it won't matter because it's on the gamblers to get up and do it themselves. People have to do what Emily is doing. People have to do what Scotty's doing. They have to turn on their laptop cameras and start streaming and just start small and start doing it consistently and build it as they go. But I think that's what it's going to take. It's going to take the gamblers saying, you know what? I don't have to wait for the league to tell me to do or the jockey club or the track to tell me to do this. If I'm going to be handicapping today, I'll just turn on my laptop and I'll do it on my stream. And I'll see who wants to come along for the ride. And if people start doing that, I think that viewers will show up. And over time, I think we could introduce this game to a whole new audience on Twitch who are flipping around on Twitch, looking for the next new thing, hungry for something new. And I talk about in the piece about how Twitch has created huge audiences for very obscure and weird games because there's just so many people on Twitch who are just looking for what's the new thing. I want to watch, this is interesting. I want to watch this and learn this, and maybe I could do it. And most of those games, you can't win money at, but this one you can. So I just think that people will flock to it.
Well, I'm going to send up. I put up the link to the first to the GameStop piece, and now I'll put the link again to the ABR piece for people to check it out if they missed it last week, and we can certainly follow this kind of conversation up with Scotty Emily and some of the other people that are interested. You talked to Andrew, I'm going to forget his last name, that had that incident over Christmas. That's when I first sort of saw what was, Andrew Blackmore, tried to get some support, internally from the industry to do something along these lines as well, and was rebuffed. But it sure feels like it's an avenue that is going to get explored, even if it drags portions of the industry along with it.
Yeah. I also interviewed a guy from the NBA 2K League, which is the NBA's kind of esports league, about what they've done too. And if anything, I think one way that the industry at large could help spur this along is, we have so many great contests that happen throughout the year, is if we, you know, had a contest where the players in the contest, you know, like an invitational or something, where the players had to stream. It's a little bit difficult. You'd have to have a delay so they couldn't see what each other was doing. But, you know, there's ways that you could think about doing something similar, creating a league, doing some sort of league play with contests. But I don't think any of that will hold a candle to what finding a couple of really good, genuine, unique, you know, outsized personalities could pull off if they get on Twitch and start streaming and found an audience. You know, one or two of those. There's someone out there that's going to end up having 500,000 followers on Twitch if they get up and start doing it now.
Dave Hill, everybody, and of course we can't close out without asking how goes the home front, and are you back in the house, or is CBS still pioneer, you know, still having commandeered the house?
No, we're in the house. Yeah, it's all good.
Did we get details of what the production was and when we can see the interior on our screens at home?
No, they ended up not doing the production because of the weather. Maybe they're going to reschedule it. Yeah, because we're under 3 feet of snow here, so suddenly the scene didn't work anymore. So,
yeah. Too funny.
So we'll
have
to stay tuned for that.
Well, you got to stay tuned. Dave Hill, 77, and you should be signed up for Dave's postcards and for everything that's coming out of the Dave Hill factory, as it were, because it's always engaging. Dave,
thanks
so much.
Thank you. Thanks for everything. Talk to you soon.
Not at all. Dave Hill, everybody. And if you haven't read both pieces, you got it'll take up maybe about 20 minutes plus, 25 minutes of your day. You can break it up lunchtime or when you get home from work or while you're at work. And since you work from home, nobody's looking over your shoulder. You can read the piece at ABR. And I'm just sending out that link. And earlier I sent, again, his piece in the Ringer, and Michael McCaskill, and I think Michael's listening because he tweeted that he had tuned in, and so the next logical question, and I'm still not going to say how much the McCaskills made, but we're thrilled for him and his family, and there's only a small amount of that money, Michael, that will get you a racehorse right there running at the Downs. So think about that. All right. Get, and there's gotta be a cute name. There's gotta be a great GameStop horse name involved. If you want to do that, let's take a break. Went a little longer with Dave Hill than expected. And I thank him for, the 45 plus. I get Dave on and I just love hearing, you know, how he approaches it and you know, how he does what he does. I mean, his writing is just unbelievable. And, of course, the Vapors, if I'm sending out links, if you don't have the Vapors on your bookshelf yet, on your nightstand, wherever you read in your home or on your Kindle, be sure to get it. And we're watching and tracking, hopefully, everything works for bringing the Vapors to the screen. We'll take a timeout. Thanks to Mattress Mac earlier, too, to start the show off. Guy gave us a roaring start. Sid Fernando, Sire Watch, Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. We obviously have to talk about the weekend and Mandaloon, the latest, the latest success for Into Mischief. Just some more that happened over the weekend. Another Twirling Candy with Ron Bauer. I got to reach out to the Fradkins. And I'd love to get John and Diane Fradkin to come on and talk about, you know, their breeding program that has produced Ron Bauer and you know, and more. And we'll probably, you know, since we're going to talk Mandaloon and three-year-olds, with Into Mischief, I suppose, well, Mischief is Alex, too, you know, on the older front. But, we'll just let Sid riff. Back after this, hour two at the races, Sirius XM.
The latest race. racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Porschebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Porschebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Porschebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Porschebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Sirius XM Sports presents...